Well, they call economics the dismal science, but that's kind of sad because economics is most of what we do every day. You know, you think might think of it as being the Federal Reserve or the stock market, but you're doing economics when you pick out what you're going to have for dinner, and you're certainly doing it when you're giving values to your kids about what how they should spend their lives. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth. Our topic today is economics and thinking clearly about our economic choices. And I'm really excited about it. This is a topic that I have done a lot of work on and really turns me on. And I've got a really interesting guest in the studio today, Kyle Hampton, who is with the College of Business and Public Policy at UAA, and he directs the UAA Center for Economic Education. Thanks for being with us, Kyle.
Glad to be here.
So one of the big things that's happened in economics in recent years is that we've done more to recognize the errors or the common mistakes that we make in our everyday lives when we do things that don't make any sense. And you and I were talking before we got on the air about the lottery that's done every year for people to get permits to go on the road into Denali National Park, and how much they'd be willing to pay for that opportunity as opposed to how much they would accept to sell that opportunity, which is such an interesting conundrum. Explain that.
Yeah, this is this concept of loss aversion is one of the first anachronisms of human behavior that behavioral economists started noticing. And that was that folks require a great deal more to give something up that they currently own than they would pay to get the item in the first place. And so with the road lottery, you see this sort of thing, these spots on in if you're lucky enough to win, you
and
get
a
permit.
And this is the end of the season. Where
the
they,
end of the season, yeah. Absolutely. If you're
Park
lucky enough to win.
Some people can drive in there, normally they can't, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry. Yes, yeah, so the idea here is these things are transferable. If you're lucky enough to win the lottery to get this permit, you can actually sell this permit on Craigslist, and you notice that these permits are going for upwards of $500 and $600. And in just some of the casual conversations I've had with people who are lucky enough to win, they all tell me the same thing. They would never think of paying $500 or $600 to actually do this, but they also wouldn't think once they had won, they wouldn't even consider the idea of selling their rights into the park at that point. And there's been a number of experiments that have confirmed this phenomenon. It's one of the many... I don't want to say bizarre, but it's one of the interesting proclivities of human beings that falls a little bit outside of the assumptions that economic theory oftentimes makes.
So do you think about these things when in your daily life and try to behave in a more economically rational thing, or just say, well, I'm a human being, I can do whatever I want?
You know, that's a great question. I remember when I was first starting to read more about behavioral economics, and I have to admit, I was really caught up with the idea of human beings as these rational actors, and not necessarily descriptive, but maybe something to aspire to. And so, you know, especially when you're younger, and worse than being younger, you're in graduate school and you think you know everything. I had as a goal this idea that I would be able to overcome these irrational biases. But I'll never forget, I was on an airplane and I was reading a book by Thomas Gilovich, who was a colleague of two of the godfathers of behavioral economics, Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Kahneman later won the Nobel Prize with my mentor, Vernon Smith, in 2003, 2002. Oh, gosh, embarrassing. One of those two. I was reading this book by Gilovich, and it's called How We Know What Isn't So. And it's a little dated now, but if you can get a copy of it, it's absolutely fascinating. But I must admit, by the end of it, I was destroyed in a manner of speaking. I felt like I could not trust myself actually to make any of the assessments that I thought I was making rationally. It's a little bit, for someone who sees this sort of thing from an abstract standpoint, it can really wreck your confidence, mm-hmm. honestly.
So you are directing the Center for Economic Education. Tell us why economic education is important. Is this part of it?
This is. Honestly, there's lots of centers for economic education around the country, and they oftentimes get asked this question, why is economic education important? And there's a variety of stock answers. helps people make better decisions. It actually helps the economy if people understand the economy. It will help you make more money on the stock market, or it will possibly make you a better voter. I'm pretty skeptical of all of those, actually. For me, economics has been a lens through which to see the world. And it took a world that I found to be very complicated, that seemed very disconnected, and it started creating connections that I didn't know existed. And honestly, and I promise this to my students, it once you see economics, it's like one of those magic eye paintings. You can't not see it anymore. You see it everywhere you go, and it makes life better. It makes it richer. It makes it more exciting. It's like
stuff starts to fit together.
It does. It's honestly the same situation I had studying geology. When you go out, and are interacting with the natural world, geology, instead of just seeing how things are, you actually, if you get good at it, my understanding is, I'm not, a great geologist by any stretch, but you can see the way things came to be. And economics is really one of those things where it kind of exposes the underlying frameworks that define a lot of our lives. And our lives are very confusing. And this is a tool, I tell students that essentially economics is a tool for better reading the newspaper.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolfworth, and my guest today is Kyle Hampton, professor at the UAA College of Business and Public Policy. And we're welcoming your calls in terms of getting questions to him, disagreements, thoughts. We have some examples. I'd love to hear if you have any examples of things that you have done or you've seen others done that don't make sense, or sometimes those frustrating things where you know what would make sense and can't seem to get people to do it. So to get on the air with us, you just call 550-8433. That's 550-8433. From outside Anchorage, you can call toll-free, 888-353-5753. And email is a great way to get on the air, hometown@alaskapublic.org. I've got a computer right here, and I'll read your messages on the air. All right, another example, and this is one that I think is relevant to Alaskans because we all have high utility bills, is that it seems, as I understand, that when we invest our money, if you get 10%, you're very happy. You're happy just to get 5, if the investment's safe. But if the investment is putting more insulation in your house or buying a new furnace, we demand a much higher rate of return, even though that's about the safest investment you could get, right? Because you know you're going to be paying these utility bills no matter what. If you can knock them down and get a return on your investment in a few years, why the heck wouldn't you do it? And yet, studies show that people demand much more rate of return on those. Have you looked at that, or do you have an idea why that's happening? What could be the explanation for that?
Well, there's obviously one of the big issues that behavioral economists have dealt with is the issue of discounting. Discounting is essentially it's when we put a lower value on future returns as opposed to present returns. So this is a big deal in a variety of contexts. Obviously, it's a huge deal when talking about issues like global warming. How much do we value benefits today from growth versus potential environmental losses to us in the future and to future generations? So discounting is a big deal, and oftentimes people display attitudes about the future that, standing back from it, we would say aren't particularly rational. A classic example of this in the laboratory is the marshmallow experiment. So the marshmallow experiment operates as follows. They take young people, I think typically the ages are between 5 and 7 years old. They take folks, they bring them into a room and they put a marshmallow in front of them. And the child is then asked to not eat the marshmallow. And if they do not eat the marshmallow by the time the experimenter comes back, then they'll be given a second marshmallow. But otherwise, they just get the first marshmallow. So they looked at how long these young people were able to wait in order to get the second marshmallow. And then the really fascinating part of this research is they tracked those young people throughout their lives. And it turns out that the ability to basically to subvert your desires, your present desires, in order to get more in the future, that ability is incredibly correlated with life success. Those folks are less likely to get into drugs. They're less likely to enter into single motherhood and definitely are more likely to go to college. All of these things require a solving of this
discounting. Possibly also less likely to be fun at a party.
Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, this is a huge issue because it's been discovered that this ability to discount is actually fairly well correlated with family income. Hmm. And so this could be part of where a lot of intergenerational poverty traps are coming from. And if there's some way to actually train young people to increase their willpower, then that's something that's worth looking at. And in fact, I'm working with a colleague actually down in the Los Angeles area who's working for a charity who's trying to think up ways to actually train young people to increase their willpower and then tracking those folks and seeing how effective those techniques
are. So like another example, what you're talking about is getting a kid to stay in school.
Yes.
You know, finish that one more year of high school.
Yes.
It may seem like torture, but for your future earnings, it's enormous. And,
absolutely.
And if you were thinking about it rationally, of course, you'd never consider not doing it. And I'm sure there are many others. And,
mm-hmm.
But it raises a question of how much is really psychology, right? I mean, it's and even the nature nurture thing about where does it come from?
Oh, absolutely.
Is that part of economics now?
Yes, I would say so. Honestly, when I was an undergraduate at the University of South Carolina, I was a philosophy major really through most of my career, and I was lucky enough to get exposed at that time to to something very heterodox at that time, which was experimental economics, which was instead of just broadly talking about theory, especially in with these large scale mathematical models, instead it was actually getting into the laboratory the way psychologists do and looking at the way folks make decisions. And that was very exciting for me because I felt like for the first time this was my opportunity to do experimental philosophy. And it, of course, being exposed to economics, I realized it was also a much more economical decision on my part to go into graduate work
right.
on economics instead of philosophy. But it was extremely exciting. I was very lucky at that time to be connected with some of the weirdos who are at the forefront of this way of looking at things. So it's now become much, much more mainstream. My graduate studies were at the University of Arizona and George Mason University with Vernon Smith, who, like I said, with Dan Kahneman in 2002, won the Nobel Prize for a lot of the contributions he was making in this field. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, you and I were talking before we started. I think there's a bit of straw manning that goes on when people talk about economics. They have this idea that economists assume that human beings are these robots. They call it homo economicus, rational maximizers who have access to all of this information. And that's obviously false. That's not something that really describes people as we know them. And I think, honestly, that economics is hard. It's difficult for a lot of folks. And it's one of the things that we do in order to deal with information that oftentimes may counter what we want to believe or have been led to believe is we're looking for reasons not to expend an extraordinary amount of effort figuring something out or learning a new discipline. And so it's become a way for folks to kind of dismiss what economics mm-hmm. is all about. But the way I think about traditional economics is it's like Newtonian physics, and behavioral economics is quantum mechanics it's something mm-hmm. that's as much a compliment. In some regards, it's replacing what we knew previously, but in other regards, it's just complimenting.
Well, I think we may have gone beyond the knowledge base of listeners.
Oh,
when we talk
so
about that's okay. But when we talk about experimental economics, mm-hmm. that's a concept that seems odd. We're not doing experiments exactly with like spending money in the community and seeing who buys and sells it. Buys and sells what, which is sort of what you think of as economics. You're actually going into a lab.
Absolutely.
And so give me an example of an experiment that you might do.
Sure.
You're doing them here at UAA?
Oh, absolutely.
Give us an example of what that looks like from beginning to end.
Okay. Well, the traditional experiment, the first experiment that Vernon Smith ran in the 1950s was a double auction. And so how this worked was that you had folks who were assigned the role of buyers, and you had folks who were assigned the role of sellers. And the sellers were told their cost for selling an item. So every item they sold, they incurred a cost. And the buyers had these values. So every item that they purchased, they would receive some value in cash terms. Now, this money, so if you were a seller and you could sell an item at a price that was greater than your cost, that difference you actually received in cash at the end of the experiment. So
you get to go home with it. You're not pretending. You're
absolutely
actually have an opportunity to make some money.
Right. And, you know, that's the difference between economic experiments and psychology experiments really come down to that. Psychologists tend to deal more with hypotheticals, whereas economic experiments almost always pay the subjects for their participation and pay them on the basis of decisions that they're making. So buyers, going back to the double auction experiment, you've got these sellers with costs, the buyers have values, and the value that these buyers have, again, if the price is less than their value, then they get the difference and they walk home with that. Now, without going too deeply into it, essentially, economics is all about supply and demand. Supply is really nothing more than a representation of all the costs of all the sellers in a market. And demand is the value that all the buyers have for a particular good. And so the prediction is that these two things, curves that they are, this is very difficult without graphs.
Yeah,
it's
right.
So difficult for an economist not to have these graphs. But the upshot of this is that the markets performed remarkably similar to what theory predicted. They did an amazing job of coming to a price that would have been predicted by economic theory. And Vernon, at the time, he had run this with the idea that the world was far more complicated than mere theory. And so when he got these results, he was shocked. So he ran it again, and he got the same results. Mm-hmm. And it's really one of the most robust experiments that we run. I run it every single semester in both of my classes because it does such an amazing job of showing the power of markets to take all this disparate information. Each person only has their tiny little piece of the puzzle, their tiny little piece of information mm-hmm. about values and costs. And through interacting with one another and being focused almost, you know, entirely on your own profit, the result is something that maximizes the well-being for everybody in the room. The result is such that these guys take as much profit from the experimenter as they possibly can, and that's kind of a proxy for what we would call in the business economic efficiency.
You'd need a bunch of mathematics to figure that out.
Right.
But they can figure it out without even knowing it just by interacting.
Yeah.
So give me an example of one that shows behavior that is not optimal, or is it not as predicted?
Well, there's been several experiments. Okay, so for example, we have the classic would be a prisoner's dilemma experiment, let's set up this game. We've got five individuals, and you're going to give each of these five people $50. Now, they have the choice with that $50. They can either keep the $50 for themselves, or they can put some portion of that $50 into a public account. What we're going to do is we're going to take everything that's put in the public account, we're going to double it, and then we're going to distribute it back to everybody and distribute it equally regardless of how much they put in. Now, economic theory looks at this and they say, no one's going to contribute anything. Because if everybody else is contributing, then my best deal is to contribute nothing. So, for example,
you're still going to get the payout.
I would still get the payout. So
it's like being in a poker game and you don't have to ante, but you still get to take the pot.
Precisely. And if no one contributes, it's still my best bet not to contribute. But when people actually do these experiments in the laboratory, a shocking number of folks actually contribute. Another classic example would be the ultimatum game.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple, very straightforward. Player one is given $10, and player one can then choose how much of that $10 to give to player two. Player two then has a choice. They can either accept what they've been given, in which case both individuals walk away with the money that they've been that has been allocated to them, or player two can say, no, I refuse, in which case nobody gets anything.
Right.
Now, of course, an economist would say that player two would never refuse anything if it were positive.
If it was more than zero.
If it
right.
were more than zero. And knowing this, player one will keep nine for themselves and give one to player two. First of all, player twos are very willing to crash the whole system mm-hmm. for both parties if they feel like they're not getting what's fair. And probably more amazingly, player ones know this before it's even happened and typically split the pot 5-5, knowing that possibility of
yeah, it's fascinating. I've studied this, and one explanation which I'd be interested in hearing if you agree with is that we have sort of a built-in social desire of we want to enforce fairness. Mm-hmm. We want people to treat one another fairly. player two is prepared to sacrifice in order to punish player one if he's not fair. Mm-hmm. And player one knows that player two has that aspect of his personality, and so he's not going to try to short him.
Oh, absolutely. And again, we can think of a lot of environments in which this sort of attitude would be very important to human flourishing, these attitudes towards fairness. So when I talk about these results with my students, I'm always stressing, look, there probably were groups of human beings that were far more selfish and didn't have this innate desire for fairness that human beings seem to have. They're gone now.
Right.
I mean, that was the idea that the experiment where people are contributing into the public pool, that's the same problem that would be faced by, you know, folks on the savannah. Your individual tribe is being threatened by outside invaders. And so you all have to cooperate to go out into the field and defend your crops. And, you know, if people behaved like economists thought they behaved, well, then, the rational thing for a person would be to say, okay, you know, the guys, all right, we're ready. And then, you know, the dominant strategy, as we'd say in economics, is sit in the back, right? And if everybody's doing that, then that's a group of humanoids that isn't going to survive very long.
And we can see that in a tribe where you had one person who did that.
Right.
He might make an advantage for a little while, but then he's probably going to be kicked out, probably
absolutely.
Isn't going to get a mate and so forth.
Yes,
so,
yeah. Absolutely. And so, you know, a lot of these things that where we would look at it and we'd say that's irrational from the standpoint of the individual, these things are extremely rational from the standpoint of the group. And so since we have, evolution affects both groups and the individual, it makes sense that that through evolution, a lot of these characteristics of human beings that aren't strictly rational would actually come to be.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. So we're on the air with Kyle Hampton, who's a professor with the UAA College of Business and Public Policy. Show is Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we certainly welcome calls and involvement and interested parties to join our conversation. All you do is call 550-8433 in Anchorage or out of town, toll-free, 888-353-5752, and the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And now I'm going to turn to Caroline, who has a comment. Caroline?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
You just touched on some of the things that I was going to ask you about, because I've read some of these experiments, and the thing that I've thought about, you know, I'm getting up in age, I'm born in 44, so it was like, you're just thinking like an old codger. That's what I call myself when I start thinking that way, that things are so much worse now than they were back then. I mean, I remember the strike, the boycott, I should say, of grapes from California because of the way the pickers were being treated. And I look around and I say, would anybody boycott anything for the benefit of somebody that they don't even know? And my thought is, no, they wouldn't. And balancing that is, growing up in the South, when racism was really seemed like the dominant force, I looked around and said, you know, the poor whites and the blacks are both poor. Why don't they combine? But the force of that racism drove them apart. Now, listening to what you just said, I wanted to ask, I heard kind of there was more than Homo sapiens, and I was just wondering if part of the reason they didn't manage to hang around, well, I'm sure there were a number of things like diet and so forth, but the fact that they didn't have each other's back.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about this issue of altruism. How did altruism get into humanity? And I think one of your good points there, Caroline, is that it also has a parochial aspect, right? You might be more fair with somebody who's within your group than somebody who's outside of your group.
Absolutely. Gosh, we could spend the rest of our talk on this on this concept, because this is something that I too am very interested in. You're absolutely right. There are in-group effects that are very positive, but oftentimes come at the expense of out-groups. So oftentimes, in order to preserve cooperation within the group, there's the need to demonize folks who are outside that group. Right now, the Rasmussen chair. So every couple of years, actually, we have the Rasmussen chair. That is an endowed chair in the economics department at UAA. This year's Rasmussen chair is actually an evolutionary psychologist, Robert Kurzban, and he actually asks a very interesting question. So a lot of economists will tell you that, just like what I said, a lot of these things that we think of as morality, these things evolved, and they evolved to help us solve coordination problems. They evolved to help us help human beings work together to cooperate. And you can see, you know, if you have some sort of moral rule that says you're supposed to pitch in and help out and do your fair share, those things make sense. But what he was confused about are certain moral taboos that occur seemingly randomly in different cultures around the world. Things like menstruation taboos, food taboos, masturbation taboos, things that aren't directly addressing cooperation between individuals. And he's curious then, what were the evolutionary forces that kind of drove the development of these taboos? And I really, this is very new to me, and I was very excited about his reasoning here. His argument is this: the worst thing in nature that can occur is a fair fight. Absolutely the worst thing in nature. And so nature actually goes to great lengths.
Because then both sides get beat up.
Both sides get beat up. I mean, I recently saw a documentary on our efforts in South Vietnam during the Vietnam War, and this is a perfect example of that. We helped the South Vietnamese just enough to get lots of them killed, and because we created that balance between those two groups.
If they got beat right away, they would have been better off.
Exactly. Right? And so nature knows this, and it has all sorts of different size horns, different colors to warn folks off to eliminate these sorts of conflicts. Robert Kurzban's argument is that actually these moral rules could be just about anything, that in fact what they represent is a focal point so that society can consolidate their support of one side or the other of these sorts of conflicts, so that if you have this one thing that you can point to and say, this person broke this moral rule, adultery in the case of, you know, in Nathaniel Hawthorne, or any of these other sorts of moral rules, if we all consolidate and say that that's a bad thing, then that's going to help us all basically join the winning side so there's not this conflict. Mm-hmm. And the upside of this that I found fascinating is that the taboo could be anything. It really, and that's why it is various across different cultures.
Just helping the group hold together.
Yep, absolutely. As long as it's something upon which we can agree, then it could be anything. It could absolutely be anything. And that's why we see a lot of very strange taboos and taboos that are very diverse across cultures.
Mm-hmm. Caroline?
Could I mention one quick thing about Alaska? When I first got to Fairbanks in 67, one of the things I loved about Fairbanks was at 40 and 60 below, this is before any cell phones, you didn't care who stopped to help you.
Right.
You could easily freeze to death. And that underlayment of we've got to help each other because we could die out here. Mm-hmm. That took care of the racism, and I was just thrilled with the chance to live amongst people who understood how much they needed each other.
Yeah,
that's a great point.
I always enjoy your calls. That gives us a good segue into talking about how some of this stuff relates to Alaska. We have a lot of economic issues that are unique. And one is what's been called the tragedy of the commons, where we have a lot of fisheries and natural resources which are either open to all and may be therefore overexploited, or that are controlled by one mechanism or another through, you know, either conversion to private property or through some kind of permit scheme. And I know that there's a lot of experimental economics that's gone on to look at that. Some of it's surprising, though. And we were talking earlier about the work of Eleanor Ostrom. Her husband, Vince Ostrom, was one of the consultants who helped draft the Alaska Constitution. And then she went on to win the Nobel Prize in looking at different systems that avoid this problem of the tragedy of the commons. And anyway, Kyle, maybe you can sort of summarize what is the tragedy of the commons, and it's a pretty familiar idea to a lot of people, I think. And then what's the flip side that we've been finding out?
Well, the tragedy of the commons is actually the state of nature. It really is. It's in, you know, and I consider myself a bit of a Hobbesian, a fan of the philosopher Thomas Hobbes, that in the absence of any sort of state regulation, that it's a war of all against all. And so what that means is we have these scarce resources, these natural resources. And if there's no means of excluding folks from these resources, then we would expect the resources to be overexploited.
So, for example, a fishery.
Absolutely.
If everybody can take as much as they want,
right,
pretty soon it'll be gone.
Yeah, as I tell my students, fish are delicious, absolutely, but so are cows, and so are pigs, and so are chickens, and there's absolutely no threat whatsoever to the populations of any of those animals, whereas fish are very different. And I always get a lot of blowback from my Alaskan students, but yeah, for the most part, when we go into the grocery store, there is one item that is actually still cultivated wild, and that's seafood. And that just so happens, not just so, I don't think it's coincidental at all, that those are the most threatened environmental resources, really, that are out there. So the Tragedy of the Commons essentially says that if a fisherman shows up, well, let me tell you the classic story. Jared Diamond tells this story in his book Collapse. For years, Easter Island was a mystery. I remember when I was younger, this was in the late 1970s, early 1980s, when everyone was obsessed with UFOs and unsolved mysteries. And so the idea was that the giant heads that appear on Easter Island were in fact put there by aliens, because that was the only way possible. And the confusion came from the fact there were no trees on Easter Island, and trees would have represented a way, A, to build scaffolding to raise these monuments, and also could be used as wheels to wheel these things around. So everyone was very confused. How did they get these statues up and without these trees? The archaeologists started looking in the quarries where they got the rocks, and they found logs, just tons and tons of logs, and not the kind of logs that could have floated there either. The dawning realization was, in fact, that Easter Island and the folks who had come to Easter Island had killed all the trees. And so Jared Diamond asked the question, what did that Eastern Islander say, that last tree, as they were cutting down that last tree? Of course, my students being hilarious always say Tim Burr, but actually, as I tell them, the answer was, if I don't take this tree, that doesn't mean the tree is going to persist anyway. It means somebody else is going to take the tree, and so long as that's the case, I might as well be the one who takes it. And so it's a recasting of the type of problem we described earlier, where everybody would be better off if they put $50 into the public account, but as an individual, I'm better off not doing so. Mm-hmm. And it's the same situation. We all know that if we fish less, that there will be more fish available to us long term, but as an individual, I have no guarantee that other people are going to do that. So if I find an adolescent fish in my net, throwing it back in so that it reproduces does me no good, because there's no guarantee that that fish is right, going to still be there when I come back.
So I want to talk more about this after the break and find out if is that how Alaskans do we see ourselves that way? Would we throw the fish back? Are we competitors? Do we have some cooperation in this? It's talking about economics, and we'll be talking more about other natural resource issues. I'm enjoying the hour. I hope you are too. We'll be back in just a few minutes on Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
We're back, Hometown Alaska, and we're talking about economics today and how economics informs our everyday lives. And we're now talking about some Alaskan resource issues and how this new science of behavioral economics can tell us something about how we treat Alaska, how we use its resources, and how we share or deplete our resources. And we'd be very interested in your comments and thoughts with my guest, Kyle Hampton from the UAA College of Business and Public Policy. You can get on the air with us by calling 550-8433 or from outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Kyle, we were talking about the Tragedy of the Commons and this tendency we have to compete until everything's gone. But obviously that hasn't happened in every case. There's still a lot of natural resources out there. Alaska Native seem to have in some way reached an equilibrium with their environment, and now we have systems for dealing with it in terms of our fisheries. What are the different alternatives or the different ways that we go about avoiding destroying our environment?
Well, you had mentioned Eleanor Ostrom earlier, mm-hmm. and Eleanor was a big chronicler of how indigenous groups manage collective resources and communal resources. And in many cases, it requires the development of a shared communal ethos about how to manage these resources. I was in Hawaii teaching for a while, and there was a very interesting story about the development of the taboos there, which they call kapu. They would create this taboo on a particular fishing area, for example, when it was being overfished as a way to keep folks from overfishing those spots. So that would be an example of how strong leadership within a community can propagate this particular idea that helps promote cooperation between folks so they don't overexploit the resource. But oftentimes groups can do this from the bottom up as well. Things become more difficult when we're dealing with a more cosmopolitan environment. The rise of globalization and the rise of markets and really the rise of economics mm-hmm. has been one where a lot of these types of tools for helping coordinate within the community, these tools oftentimes become less valuable because there's so much interaction between people from different cultures.
So if I'm living in a native village and that ecosystem is in my entire life, then in my entire sustenance, then I might work with my neighbors to make sure that it's protected. But as soon as I can catch a bunch of fish, sell them, and invest the money in the stock market, I have a different incentive.
Right. And fish are an excellent example. Where fish tend to congregate, it's much easier to solve these sorts of problems of the tragedy of the commons. You can find ways to actually exclude people from overfishing these areas. But for something like tuna, which is one of the most exploited species on the planet, tuna migrate long distances and leave sovereign nations. And the result of that is that you have a lot of different folks who are trying to hunt down those tuna who do not share a culture, who do not share a language, and because of the nature of fishing, may never even see each other. So these traditional kind of cultural means of moderating overexploitation of resources kind of fall to the wayside, and we need some different types of tools. Mm-hmm. And that's where economics comes in. Economics has, promotes the idea of property rights. A lot of economics is contingent on the idea of property rights. And that's one of the things I find so exciting about Alaska and a lot of what Alaska has done. The North Pacific fishery is, by all accounts, the best managed fishery on the entire planet. And a big reason for that is cap and trade. This is, the traditional notion of property rights,
otherwise known as IFQs.
Sorry, yes, absolutely. But the reason why I say cap and trade is because I know that those words actually have some emotional resonance when we're mm-hmm. talking about things like global warming and climate change. It's important. I like to stress to my students that cap and trade is not a new idea. Cap and trade is actually something that we up here in Alaska. We helped invent. And the idea with cap and trade is that instead of owning each individual fish, as we might think property rights might suggest we do, instead, you don't own the individual fish. There's some set amount of fish that can be taken from the population. The scientists tell us what the sustainable level of fish would be, and then there's some sustainable level of harvest. They specify those permits, and then the permits are tradable. And the beauty of that is that the folks who have the highest value for the fish or the lowest cost of getting it are the ones who are going to get those permits. But it's a kind of property right. And, for the types of goods that are really difficult to design a market around, oftentimes these creative kind of quasi-property rights are our only option, including with the issue of global warming.
So once you own your quota of fish, you can't overharvest, mm-hmm. and also you have a presumably have a conservation interest in the totality of the fish, so that there'd be more and you can take more.
When they first introduced the IFQs in New Zealand, and down there they're called ITQs, individual tradable quotas, I believe that's right, they actually allowed the fishermen to get together within a co-op, and those fishermen worked together to reduce the number of fish they were taking even below what had been specified by the government there as the sustainable harvest. So by creating this ability for folks to coordinate, you can actually get past a lot of the difficulties people would ordinarily have with cooperation. And that's one of the upshots of Eleanor Ostrom's work that's really exciting.
So in terms of cap and trade for the environment, for air and for climate change, the idea is that you get a permit that allows you to pollute a certain amount, and then you can sell that permit to somebody else if you can avoid polluting. And
right.
So you put a price on pollution and or carbon emissions and hold it down that way.
Right. And the beautiful thing about that, one thing that people don't realize is that really the effects of cap and trade and a carbon tax are essentially the same. And the idea is in both cases to make it costly to pollute. The beautiful thing about cap and trade when it comes to pollution is that it does two things. First of all, reducing carbon dioxide emissions is extremely expensive and costly to growth, economic growth, which obviously as an economist is something that I take very seriously and tend to promote. So if you were to just say, everybody reduce your carbon output by 20%, that would be a very inefficient way to get the reductions that you needed. Some folks, it would be very easy to make that 20% reduction. Other folks, it would be very difficult. What you want to do is make sure that those folks that are polluting or are creating carbon dioxide are the ones who are creating the most economic value for the pollution that they're creating. And that's one thing that these tradable permits do. The other thing that it does is...
So just to make sure that's understandable, if you are... it's easy for you to cut your emissions because maybe you're really not getting that much out of making these emissions. So then you can make more money by selling those permits for emissions to somebody else who's actually getting a lot of value out
right.
of it.
Or for whom it's very difficult to reduce their emissions,
right.
like aluminum smelters.
So then the totality of the economy does better based
right.
on that, because it's sort of moving the emissions to where they're needed.
Mm-hmm. And I think really the even more important aspect of cap and trade is that even if we give a company these permits such that they can continue to pollute, there's still a cost involved in the pollution, and that is what you could receive by selling that permit to somebody else. And so there's always an incentive for you to be innovating and finding new ways to reduce carbon dioxide, because this profit motive is essentially driving you to do so.
So part of what we're talking about there is putting a price on goods that belong to all of us. So the clean air and the future environment belongs to everyone, and you are forcing people who are going to diminish that to pay for it. And that comes up a lot in Alaska, and I'm thinking particularly of an issue like the Pebble Mine issue, which we're facing, where there's a big underground resource that could be taken out for private profit, and then there's a big public resource that benefits a lot of other people in terms of the clean water and the fish. Figuring out how to balance those is very difficult. And so we're going to talk about that for a few minutes on Hometown Alaska. My guest today is Kyle Hampton. He's a professor with the UA College of Business and Public Policy. And if you want to get involved in our conversation in the last quarter hour here, the phone number is 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Kyle, it seems to me that a lot of the things that are valuable in my life feel almost like they don't have anything to do with economics, because I'm not ready to buy and sell them. And I would put, you know, obviously my family, my health, and then, you know, nature, places that I want to go to, you know, the opportunity to go catch a big salmon. How do we ever figure out when we're prepared to, obviously we have to make choices, you know, some people will say there's no amount of minerals that could be in Pebble Mine that would be worth harvesting. Others would say, well, maybe there is a number, and then others who own those minerals and that opportunity are ready to do it. So how do we figure that out? I mean, how do we make an economic decision about that when we're talking about intangible values or values that we don't want to put a number on?
Well, we economists have never found a value we didn't want to put a number on. And honestly, the reason why is because as we were talking about earlier with the double auction experiment, the power of these markets to organically and spontaneously arrive at these utilitarian, these what we would call economically efficient outcomes, we're blown away by it. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. There are people who call themselves deep ecologists because they're so enamored with the operations of nature and how it works that they get very upset at the idea of somebody manipulating them that some way. I consider myself a bit of a deep economist. I'm totally blown away by what markets are capable of. And so when we do have these really important values that aren't easily bought and sold, they're not easily resolvable through market means, I'm looking for a way in which we can do that. And Pebble, it fascinates me. It really does. I tell people, I don't think that there's not a place on this planet where a citizen has more power in a democracy than in Alaska. There's not very many of us, and the resources that essentially fall under our control are mind-blowing. Not just the resources that are under the ground, but also this responsibility to protect this wilderness. It's exciting as an economist to be in a place where each person has so much power, and it's that much more important that they understand these issues. And so with Pebble, you know, one of the things that I've been doing is trying to communicate about Pebble in a way that's not advocacy in one direction or the other. I get obviously, I'm a little disturbed by the level of conversation that's kind of been motivated by both sides of the debate. In looking back at the history of Alaska, I see things like the development of the pipeline as being really incredible negotiation between both environmentalists and folks who wanted to do this resource development. And I'm worried that we're not going to see the same kind of collaboration here because things have just gotten so polarized.
Right. But if there's a perspective of, a natural resource, the fish, this natural space that people feel a spiritual link to.
Yep.
I mean, they may not, they really may not be willing to prepare to accept any amount of money for it. Whereas there's others who maybe are not so closely linked and also have some kind of ownership interest, but maybe not quite so much. It's pretty hard to figure out how you make that decision.
It's very hard. You know, one of the things that I've been suggesting just as something that's very fun, I've been suggesting that we basically tack on a 40% tax along the lines of what's done with oil, tax those resources that are in the ground, and then give full ownership of the Pebble property to the Nature Conservancy.
All right. Explain that.
Well, so the idea here would be that there's about between $500 and $800 billion worth of resources under the ground.
Wow.
Yeah.
So just to put that in comparison, that's like multiples of all the oil ever taken out of Prudhoe Bay.
Terrence Cole estimated that the total value of every single resource that's been taken out of Alaska since 1856 is about $290 billion. So you're talking about 2 to 3 times as much as that.
Incredible.
It's an extraordinary amount of money. Now, of course, individuals, right now, the mining royalty in the state of Alaska is about 3%. And it's actually a funny story why it's so low. The idea was that we would tax fishing at a greater level because that's where all those idiots from Seattle were actually engaged in the Alaska economy, whereas mining was for those were real Alaskans doing real Alaska work.
Prospectors with a pick
exactly
over their shoulder. Right.
But so obviously that would have to change. I think it makes perfect sense that fishermen and citizens of Anchorage talking about getting 3% of that much money and giving the rest to the Pebble Partnership is, of course, that's not going to be something that we should even consider. But, you know, there's a lot of negotiations to be done here in the same way these negotiations took place for the pipeline. If the value of what's under the ground can assuage the fears and the risks that other folks, other stakeholders are actually going to be facing around the state, then from an economic standpoint, that's something that we should certainly consider. How do you do that? How do you actually find out what people's values are? That's a very difficult problem. We were talking earlier about the Exxon Valdez when the Exxon Valdez actually ran aground in the Prince William Sound. the lawyers didn't know what to do. The lawyers didn't know what to do because traditionally you would price the damages, the environmental damages, by how human beings were actually harmed. Mm-hmm. And there weren't that many human beings.
Right. I remember they did stuff like they said, well, how much does a sea otter cost if you're going to sell one to an aquarium? And they'd say, okay, $500. Or how much is a pelt for a seal? And they came up with some very low numbers for this catastrophic accident.
Absolutely. And so some of the folks at that time, some of the researchers, including my undergraduate advisor, Glenn Harrison, were motivated to discover ways of eliciting people's values that were non-use, non-hedonic. So essentially what it came down to was asking people, how much did this harm you in financial terms? How much, you know, if you could put a dollar amount on, mm-hmm. on how painful this was for you, what would it be?
Right. As I recall the survey, they actually went into people's homes and said, we're pretty sure there'll be another oil spill just as bad as this one. But if we put on a new tax, we can avoid it. Mm-hmm. How much are you willing to pay for the tax?
Right, right. And of course, the biggest difficulty with doing this sort of thing and the critique that came up during that time is that it was all hypothetical. People mm-hmm. weren't actually being asked to pay this money. One of the really exciting things going on right now, actually, at UAA is...
Just to finish that story, that the total number they came up with was, I think after they had done a whole bunch of things to cut it down and make it smaller, it still ended up being like $15 billion.
Oh, it was considerable. And again, it pretty much rewrote the book on compensatory damages for environmental harms like that. Nobody had ever seen anything like that. And it's a difficult situation because it is hypothetical, but one of the ways folks have been looking to get around this hypothetical problem is actually instead of asking people, give us a number, what they ask people to do instead is giving them a series of binary choices. Which of these things would you value more? And then you're answering questions about, I value this more than this, I value this more than this. And after you answer a lot of these questions, they get a better idea of exactly what your values are because you're actually asking, you're being asked to make these trade-offs between these different items. And that's going to eliminate some of that hypothetical bias. The folks over at UAA, including John Alavy, have done some work on this sort of thing, actually using these sorts of these choice experiments to get at what people's valuation is for these environmental goods. And it's exciting.
So give me an example of something I'd be asked to choose among.
Well, what I'm oftentimes asking folks to do when it comes to Pebble is describing what are some of the things that we could actually purchase, for example, with the money that came out of Pebble. So it might be expanding schools. It might be filling in those ruts on Glen Highway. How would you weigh this versus the protection of this particular environment or the reduction in probability that this sort of damage would happen to salmon stocks? There's a variety of different ways that you can do that and get people to face those trade-offs. And when I'm talking about Pebble and trying to get people to understand this, one of the big issues with Pebble is that if we were to give Pebble to the Nature Conservancy, the Nature Conservancy now has to face these trade-offs. Yes, of course, protecting the wilderness here in Alaska is very important. But when you think about all of the wilderness around the world that you could actually protect with the money that you could earn from the resources that came out of the ground, now we have a much more difficult set of trade-offs to make.
You could probably buy all the private property in Alaska for that amount of money.
I imagine so.
Many times over.
Yeah. I mean, I recently was watching a nature program where in Papua New Guinea, there is a orangutan, a very small piece of habitat that is where orangutans live. Sorry.
Yeah.
And I was watching this. These are incredibly charismatic animals. They're beautiful, but their habitat is being destroyed. And it's being destroyed because palm oil plantations are actually being put in their place. Now, as an economist, when I stand back from this and I think about people's attitudes towards orangutans and I think about palm oil, I mean, I'm sure palm oil is a great product. But to me, that looks like something that's highly inefficient, where a market would actually have society weighing the value of that orangutan habitat much higher than the value of that palm oil. That's the sort of thing that the Nature Conservancy oftentimes deals with because their method for conservation is attempting to weigh development versus protection and when development will allow allow them to gain resources that will allow there to be more protection and more conservation elsewhere, they make those hard choices. They make those hard trade-offs. So,
but it's kind of tough on the folks who live there, isn't it?
Because, oh, absolutely.
Because if and that brings it to the question that you were talking about earlier about property. Who actually owns Pebble? I mean, I guess from a legal standpoint, it belongs to the state of Alaska.
It does.
And the folks who have filed the mining claims. But from sort of a moral sense, you think that the people who live near it probably have more of an ownership right than somebody who lives, you know, in Ketchikan or in Barrow. And we talked earlier about the Exxon Valdez. These studies that were done where they did the survey were nationwide. They asked everybody in the country and then added it all up. So from that point of view, I guess the harm was considered to belong to all American citizens. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if they'd done it just for Alaskans, the number would have been much smaller because there are fewer Alaskans. But why didn't somebody in Europe have a right to not want Prince William Sound to be oiled?
Absolutely.
So how do you figure out like who actually gets to make the choice and make that, you know, decide between those two things you're talking about?
Honestly, that's a very hard problem, but it's one of the things that excites me about Alaska is that these are the types of problems that we have to face with so much of the decisions about resource protection and development happening on these public lands. This is something that we have to figure out collectively. I'm not sure I can come up with the ideal, but I'm pretty sure I can say that the level of discourse that we're seeing in the television ads from both sides is a little bit lower than what I'd be aiming
for. Not going to get us there.
No.
Yeah. Here's an email from a listener. Your guest comment about the indigenous or American Indian cooperative that limited, or no, you were talking, I guess, about an Australian group that limited itself to fishing even less than the sustainable guidelines, reminded me that monopolies maximize their profits by limiting supply, ultimately at the expense of the consumer. And Larry asks, do you have any comment on that?
That's excellent. That is a perfectly reasonable, if cynical, way to look at the decisions that they were making. And I think that's absolutely true. Economics is very much about trade-offs. And in this case, monopoly, while it does have the value of facilitating cooperation, oftentimes that cooperation is exactly what we don't want. So one of the things that we do to limit cooperation, for example, between businesses that might be colluding is limiting their ability to communicate with one another so as to reduce the chances that they can make these deals. This is one of the things I find very exciting about economics is that that tension between cooperation and competition. Mm-hmm. And it's a constant battle. It requires vigilance to try to design these institutions that are going to get us the right balance of those two things.
Right. And I think that was one of Professor Ostrom's big things. Hey, we just have a minute left, and I want to give you a chance to sum up, because I know you're working in terms of educating the community about these kinds of issues. How do you do that? What are you involved in at the university?
Well, at the university, obviously, I teach a few classes. The big project that we're working on right now, two big projects. One is taking these experiments that we talked about, which are excellent teaching tools, mm-hmm. and putting these experiments on smartphones so that they can be utilized very quickly in a large classroom by college educators. So trying to get more of the educational and behavioral type aspects into economics. The other thing that we're doing locally is we're working in to build these web modules to train teachers in rural Alaska how to teach financial literacy and economic literacy to those students. So building those sorts of tools for folks to use is a big priority for us right now.
Great. Well, thanks. This has been a fascinating discussion for me. I hope the listeners enjoyed it. I think many of them probably did, because we have some pretty smart listeners. My thanks to my guest, Kyle Hampton. He's a professor with the UAA College of Business and Public Policy. Next week on Hometown Alaska, join host Kathleen McCoy when she hosts Beyond the Bear author Deborah McKinney, who was the writer who partnered with bear attack survivor Dan Bigley and the doctor who saved his life, James Kalman. That's next week on Hometown Alaska. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can hear today's archive show there. And you can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Kristen Speck is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.